to agree it sounds stupid. But no, this is the first time I've heard about this APU. I don't even know how that works.
I know of drivers who have them, but I haven't gotten all my questions answered about them either. I know one guy has one right now, but he doesn't really pay that much attention to it. He's just like, oh, it turns on and off whenever it wants to, and blah, 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 keeps the truck up to temperature, keeps the fuel at the temperature, keeps the oil up to temperature, keeps the batteries up to the proper voltage. When they start running low, it turns on and turns the engine on, and then as soon as it reaches back to where it needs to be, it turns off again, and just, I'm like, okay, wow, interesting. I'm trying to figure out everything there is to know about it, and that's where his knowledge begins and ends on it. I would like to know all the details on it. Who makes it? What all the purposes are in it? I'd like to know all about these things, but I know very little about them. I just know that some of the newer trucks have them. Not all of them, but some of them have them.
Sound interesting, but you know a lot more about them than I do. That's definitely for sure.
I do have an additional check-in that has popped up on the pre-net check-in list, so I actually have 50 check-ins tonight. The last one was KK4JD, that is Joe and Greer. I did not have him at first. Hold on, let's see. I'm going to recount these real quick. The additional one that I had was KK4JD, that is Joe and Greer, so I have 50 check-ins for tonight. I'm going to my net report now and close the net out, but I'm still here. KZM now securing the Blue Ridge 2-meter net with our thanks for checking in. We will now return the repeater back to normal amateur use. 73 to everybody and good night. D and WD8RON KJ4WZM. I'm still in here, y'all.
RON, I'm kind of listening. Over.
Okay. I'm going to Google these APUs and find out more about them. I'm curious myself.
KJ4WZM. L4EXB. Not much, sir. Just due the fact that I travel 85. Also, you ever see a blue four-door truck with the, of course, the antenna sitting on top of the cab and then a Masonic sticker in the left-hand window? That's my truck, so feel free to talk to me.
You run 146.610 in there, or you run channel 19, or you run everything?
610 pretty much all the time.
I recognize vehicle makes, models, and years. If you wanted to tell me exactly what it is, I'll see it on site and know exactly who it is in there.
Chevrolet Silverado LTZ. Definitely can't be missed. It's got the blue four-door truck with the Masonic emblem in the left top left-hand corner where the passenger seat sits on the left side.
What year is it?
2009 Silverado.
I'll definitely keep my eyes open for it. What shade of blue, roughly? Is it like a light blue, a dark blue, metallic blue, electric blue?
A bluish green.
Watch for it. And the 18-wheeler that I drive is kind of a kind of like an asphalt gray color, gunmetal gray, something like that. It's a warm but dark gray. It's a day cab, long nose Pete. It's a 389. And I'm almost always pulling a flatbed trailer behind it, a step deck flatbed trailer. Occasionally a low boy, but normally a step deck flatbed trailer.
Company does it drive for? Is it what company are drive for? Or do you have your name on it?
Small grading and utilities. It is red letters silhouetted in white and black.
Definitely. If I ever definitely see you out there and you need in or a blocker vehicle behind you to let you in or get somebody off of you, I'll definitely help you out. like to see. One thing I've definitely seen trucks do, and I like the, what they do, is when the road, the traffic is stopping, they'll sit there and center themselves in between the two lanes where people can't continue passing and be idiots just to get up three or four more cars ahead.
Definitely aggravating. One helpful thing that I've noticed that most trucks still do, too, and that I actually definitely appreciate, is when the highway suddenly comes to a standstill. Probably about half the trucks out there, as soon as they see everybody stopped up ahead, which they can see ahead farther than cars can most of the time, they'll hit their four ways. So that lets everybody know that the traffic is starting to slow down up ahead. Most trucks still do that, at least half of them. And I definitely appreciate that they still do that, at least, even if people don't get on the radio and let everybody know that the traffic is coming to a standstill, at least they still hit the four ways. And that gives people behind them enough time to hit their brakes.
That's one thing I've definitely picked up from the trucks doing that. When I see traffic starting to break ahead, I throw my hazards on.
A lot, especially when you're fully loaded.
That is definitely true. I'm not sure how much hydraulics y'all have on your truck, but there are some APUs that the military vehicles actually have that will actually run their hydraulics and on their trucks too, because some of the newer military trucks, they actually have a ramp down system that will pick up the truck and let them change the tires, which really makes it nice, and that APU will run that.
I don't think that the semi-truck APUs run the hydraulic systems at all. I'm not aware of any that do. I'm looking at these things now, and they cost more than I had imagined they do. I know that a hydraulic system itself is incredibly expensive on a 18-wheeler. They're very, very expensive. It runs on a PTO system, stands for power takeoff. Basically, it steals power out of the transmission when you flip a switch, and it's a hydraulic motor that runs the hydraulic pumps. And those are expensive, but these APUs, it says they cost anywhere from $8,500 to $13,000. So they're a lot more expensive than what I thought they were. That would explain why. So I would hazard to say few trucks run them. It's kind of a just about a luxury item, although I would call it an essential item, since given what they do. But so few trucks run them, and I guess it's because they're cost prohibitive.
KO4 PXB. Yeah, I can imagine they would be, and then you'd hate to have them stolen by somebody that's dishonest.
Especially with the fuel prices going up, like most of these APUs run right at 10 grand.
Yeah, but I guess in the long run, the cost will eventually pay off, but it was definitely an initial investment that hurt.
Basically, it would save you about $35 a night right now with the fuel prices up. That's how much the APU would save you. But if the fuel prices came back down, it would be more like $20 a night that it would save you. And it takes a long time. That's lots and lots and lots of nights to go from $20 to $10,000. So your break-even point is way out there.
A couple of years ago, me and my wife made the smart investment of getting these standby generators that will run the whole house, because we looked at the few years that we have lost power. You pretty much lose everything in your refrigerator and you have to replace it, especially big box freezers that you have a whole bunch of other meat and stuff like that. You lose all that, and then the cost of staying in a hotel, you're paying $5,000 for a generator that will run the whole house.
I'd love to have a generator. I could do, actually, I have so little stuff that I use in my house that if I prioritize my stuff and turned certain things off before turning other things on, I could probably make by with one of those little Honda 2000 generators as long as I wasn't using my microwave or something like that. But I just ran the math on the cost savings of one of those APUs. The break-even point. I'll give you a little bit of a hint before, as long as you haven't run the calculation, I'll have you guess. But the break-even point is a lot sooner than what I thought. How long do you think it would take to reach the financial break-even point of running an APU on your truck? And I just found the answer out, and it's not what I thought it was. What would be your guess?
I'd probably guess about 2.5 years.
Anybody else want to guess? I'm about to give you the answer. Here, run it for 1 year and you break even on it. That's it, 1 year. If the fuel prices were to go back down, which would slow down your break even point, you would break even at 500 nights, which would be still less than 2 years.
For VXC, probably because they look at the states that have the no idling laws, and that way, if you got caught with a fine, paying that, you know, having to pay the fine for idling your truck, because I would think they wouldn't care if you previously got a fine for idling your truck. They're just going to give you another one.
I pulled that figure. I actually ran that off of only fuel cost. Now, a no idling ticket, I'm sure, would probably cost a pretty penny as well. So if you counted that in, your break-even point would be a whole lot sooner than that. And I suppose that since you aren't idling your truck for 10 hours, I'm sure if your truck kicks on for 10 minutes to keep the batteries charged up or whatever, they're not going to fault you for idling when the truck automatically turned on and turned off on its own. But the APU itself, there's different types of them. Some of them are 100% driven on fuel. Some of them are electrically biased. They'll try to power your truck using the power from the batteries and to turn the engine on to charge your batteries and then turn it back off again when they're done. There's different types of them. APU just stands for Auxiliary Power Unit. They do different tasks. Different ones do different things, primarily electric or primarily diesel. But still very, very interesting to me. But yes, your break-even point is about a year out. So that told me all I need to know. I will definitely invest in one once I buy my own truck. Definitely.
That no idling rule states for only, I guess, in a truck lot or if you're parked on the side of the road. I'm not even sure if you're allowed to park in the shoulder if you have to pull over overnight.
If you're parking on the side of the road, they want you to park in a designated, quote, safe haven, end quote, is the terminology they use. That being either a parking lot or a truck stop or a rest area. They don't like people parking on the on and off ramps. And some states, some highways, and some metropolitan locations will actually post up these reflector rod thingies. It's a stick with a vertical stick with a reflector on it. And they'll post them up. So many of them so close together to make it impossible for any vehicle to park on the side of the road just to prevent the trucks from using the on and off ramps for parking. That's another jerk move I've seen done by the DOT just to prevent trucks from parking in places. The Northeast is not truck friendly at all. You can tell they hate trucks, and California hates trucks too. Those are truck hating places. It's not fun to go up there. But technically, you're not supposed to use the ramps for that.
KO4 PXP, my guess is you've never given a thought to be one of the ice road truckers.
To be honest with you, I have a very, very, very strange, not quite dream job, but it would be a short-term dream job for me, something I've been very interested in doing. Have you ever watched the Weather Channel much?
I watch the Weather Channel.
A show on there called Highway Through Hell. It is mostly based off of a trucking rescue team called Jamie Davis Towing, I think it's called. And there's a few others on that show as well, but that's their main character, if you will. And I would love to go up there and do heavy rescue and recovery type stuff in the snow. That would be thrilling to me. Not from the adrenaline rush side of things. I actually don't get adrenaline rushes very well at all. I hardly ever get an adrenaline rush, so I'm not an adrenaline junkie by any means. But the just the variety of it, things always, it's not like I enjoy things going wrong, but having to find the solution to puzzles you've never quite seen before, because each crash is different, has a different dynamic to come across. All the obstacles, all the mental hurdles to cross. That's the kind of stuff that I really like. I love three-dimensional problems that have to be solved. You don't have a choice about it. You just have to figure out how to do it. And after never handling one exactly like it before, that's the kind of stuff that really keeps me going mentally. I love that kind of stuff.
In the Army, I was part of a recovery team, and we had, of course, the big truck that would do recovery for wheeled vehicles. We also did track vehicles, and we got to learn to use snatch blocks and pulley blocks and mechanical advantage, and what the resistance rate is of vehicles, Mars, you know, up to the wheels, up to how far up the vehicle, then you'll be like 3 and 4 to 1 of how much that vehicle weighs if it's marred so much in the mud or water.
Interesting. So you're familiar with that kind of stuff then?
For PXP. I was in my military days. I haven't had to do that in a long time.
I have a 1992 Ford Explorer that I like to drive around when it snows. I have a 5-ton winch on that thing, and I have snatch blocks, straps, all kinds of different stuff, securement type things. And it would probably, well, I guess it wouldn't blow your mind necessarily. It might surprise you a little bit, the kinds of things that I have accomplished with that vehicle, the different vehicles that I have unstranded from the snow before and gotten them back up and rolling on the road. But it is crazy the things that I've done with that thing.
KO4 PXP, yeah, definitely no doubt, because, you know, with that winch cable, if you use those snatch blocks and increase your mechanical balance advantage, you definitely get out a lot of stuff. Just got to be able to make sure that you block the vehicle that you're using as the winch system first, or it's just going to pull it off into it.
Yep, a lot of times what I've done, where I have had to work with vehicles multiple times the size of mine, and I go to winch them out like that, I will secure my vehicle to a guardrail post or a tree or something like that on the opposite side of the road where my vehicle won't move, sometimes securing it in multiple directions at the same time before I will winch the other one back out onto the road again.
KO4VXP, and you definitely also know to not stand anywhere near that winch cable, because it will definitely cut you in half or take a leg or an arm if it comes flying back at you.
The videos on that. I have a remote control on the winch as well, so I can stand up to 300 feet away from that thing. So whatever distance the line is out from the winch, the entire length of the cable, I stand further than the entire cable's length away from it while it's working. I stand clear of that. I've got a lot of respect for what those things can do, and it happens so fast you can't react.
True, because I've saw the same thing, safety training classes in the military, when those winch cables break like that. It's just a massive whip flapping around that you're not even going to have a chance.
Interesting videos on YouTube where people have set up winches in ways to deliberately overload them, where the cable is going to fly loose. They'll tension something with a strap and a metal hook on the winch cable and stuff like that, where the strap is going to give way first. That metal hook goes flying back towards the vehicle that has it, and they'll have human dummies in the vehicle, and the winch cable will fly through the windshield in like a couple milliseconds and go through and decapitate the dummies, slash straight through the seats that the dummies are sitting in, and continue back further back into the passenger compartment of the vehicle, wreak havoc in there, and slice back out through the side of the vehicle and keep on going. I don't even know how to explain the amount of power that is inside one of those winch cables once it finally gives way like that under a load. But you don't want to be anywhere near it, and it goes so fast you don't even know what happened. It'll kill anybody within reach instantly.
BXP. Yeah, watch that. There's another thing like that on YouTube where it's got a big hydraulic press and they hook cables in between of it, and they're testing the tensile strength of the what it takes to break that cable, and it's one hell of a loud crack when it goes off.
That would be pretty crazy.
For BXP, one thing they even told us in one of these training classes that cold cables like that are easier to snap when they're cold than it is in a warm condition.
Brittle and weakens it a lot. When things are warm, it's more elastic. The closer you get, the colder it gets, and the closer you get to zero Kelvin, the more brittle everything gets. You can take a piece of steel, a large thick piece of steel, and at zero Kelvin, hit it with just about anything, and it shatters as if it was just a thin piece of glass. Anything metal reacts like that. The colder it gets, the more brittle it gets. Plastic is even worse. But then once things warm up, it's a lot better. Rubber also reacts that way. Rubber is elastic when it's warm and brittle when it's cold. So it can be really, really dangerous in the cold and very, very cold weather doing things like that, because the cables are weaker than they normally would be.
For BXP, definitely another thing dangerous besides those cables like that are any kind of acetylene bottle or oxygen bottle. When those heads fly off, I've seen it go through two or three concrete buildings and it still land about 2 football fields away.
I've never seen that. There's another interesting video if you want to look it up on YouTube. Somebody had a propane tank inside their car at a filling station, like a regular gasoline station, and they were, I think, fueling their car or something, and the propane cylinder gave way. It wasn't being messed with or anything. It wasn't involved in a crash, but the propane cylinder gave way and exploded the car to bits. The person was still standing there just fine, but it was, and they could have been killed very easily. Their car just blew apart.
Both men just check that out, because the way the propane tanks are, they have almost kind of what resembles a freeze plug, and it's supposed to blow out where it actually vents the things out the side. Those still do a lot of destructive damage, but it's supposed to have that safety valve where it blows out and vents the gas out the side.
No. Yep, you're right about that too. I don't know what caused it.
Something must have been defective of it, or somebody tampered with it and made it do that.
If you go to YouTube and you type in propane tank explodes in car, there's a video on here, and the caption reads, car rigged with illegal natural gas tank explodes while refueling at gas station.
Before PXP, I'm looking for that right now. Why for the silence?
It doesn't disappoint. That's pretty interesting looking. I just watched it again. The video I'm seeing now is from the front angle, but before when I'd seen this video, it's from the back angle. There's another one somewhere with it exploding from the back. And that footage is absolutely dramatic.
Darwin. Be careful of on fueling. It's the hoses. A couple years ago, I had a friend killed. Well, he died from it. The hose broke. Sprayed him with fuel, and he took off home. Well, first of all, he tried to get it cut off, but at the filling station, they wouldn't cut it off because they said other people would get mad because they're fueling. He drove home, and in his clothing, I don't know how long it took him, got a shower. The stuff got into through his skin because he was covered with it and really messed up his bone marrow, which produces a part of your blood, and it caused him major problems, eventually killed him. If you see that happening, I don't know how often it happens, first thing to do is get that person out of the clothing and get him under a hose and wash that stuff off. 9/11 for a hazmat situation, because they have a pool they can put them in to decontaminate them. But it's extremely dangerous if that happens, to get gasoline on you. If you get it on your clothing, get it off right away.
I'm unaware of that. KJ4WZM. Very interesting to me. And part of why, I've actually never heard of that. I knew that gasoline was a carcinogen capable of causing cancer. But other than that, I recently obtained my hazmat endorsement. I already have my tanker endorsement, so I can now go get a job driving fuel tankers, and that would be being exposed to gasoline quite frequently, so that is something that could potentially have happened to me, and I was unaware that that was even a big deal at all. I didn't know that that even mattered.
Tell the story. He had other medical problems. But I think the big thing was that he didn't get out of his clothing right away and drove home and got a shower, but it was still had permeated his skin, and it got into his bone marrow, and I've forgotten what kind of blood damage it did, but it eventually killed him.
About that, as far as I know, diesel isn't quite that bad, but I've known gasoline's bad, but I didn't know it could do that. I know you can just about drink kerosene in small quantities.
From that, too, I used to, we'd siphon gasoline by sucking on a tube, but since then we've learned to stay away from that stuff. It gets into your lungs and really messes you up.
It causes irreversible damage. That's very, very, very bad news to get petroleum distillates in your lungs like that. And it doesn't matter what form it's in, kerosene, gasoline, diesel, anything like that at all. It's just, that destroys your lungs super badly.
I've been reading stuff recently about marijuana. Smoking marijuana does irreversible damage to the lungs. If you are smoking tobacco, after about 3 years, you've cleaned out your lungs. But marijuana just builds up. It does not clean out, and eventually will cause all kinds of problems.
I'll look that up at some point. That's the first I've heard of that.
I used to think, marijuana is harmless, but as far as driving, it also cuts down on reaction time, so I think a lot of accidents are caused by that. Another thing that causes a lot of auto accidents is sleep apnea. I don't know if you've heard of that.
That's that.
No, I have it, and I know it sometimes has affected my driving to the point where I know it's affecting me, so I'll stop. But for people who don't know that they have it, I'm sure a lot of accidents are caused by that, and also by bee stings. A lot of people are actually allergic to bees, or wasps, or whatever. They get stung and can go into a shock situation. If they're driving, they'll drive right off the road, or just trying to fight off the bug as it's stinging them, and they'll drive right off the road.
I actually didn't know about that either. I knew that drunk driving kills a lot of people. I've been under the impression for a long time that driving impaired from marijuana use also kills a lot of people. Mobile phone use kills a lot of people. Driving too fast kills a lot of people. But I didn't know bee stings is on that list.
Somebody gets stung, reacts to it because it's painful. But also, some people are very allergic to it, may not realize that, or may not know it, or may know it and don't have time to get to one of their shots or medicine that they're carrying in time to administer it while they're driving.
But some people are allergic to them. They can carry an EpiPen with them and get treated in time from that. Basically, it forces your body to have an adrenaline rush, which helps combat the shock symptoms.
Very dangerous. The other thing that's interesting about bees is if you're outside at a picnic, be very careful of canned drinks. Bees are attracted to it. They'll go down into the can. You'll take a swig and get a bee in your throat. It stings you, and your throat swells up, and you can't breathe.
That one, actually. Honeybees are very, very, very interested in sugary drinks as well as yellow jackets. And it's a very good way to end up with anaphylaxis and getting a bee sting in your throat. Shock is likely from that. I've been stung many, many times from bees and wasps and everything in that stinging family. I have never, ever swelled up from them, but I have gotten lots of stings over time. Some of it out of curiosity, some of it out of stupidity, and some of it just, normal, accidental type stings.
You can survive, and painful, but if it gets in your throat, it can suffocate you. Kid, we were traveling across country, and I stepped on a bee because I was barefoot. My foot swelled up, and I couldn't get my shoe on.
What, allergic to bees?
Where have I been stung before and never had any real reaction? The reaction there was just my foot swelled up.
I've gotten bee stings before from bees that got into, I was wearing sandals and ran through a field of clover and got honeybees up underneath my feet and toes and stuff in my sandals, and they stung me so bad it hurt. It was ridiculous. But I got stung in the foot before, but that didn't happen to me at all.
Getting stung like that a whole lot can actually kill people because they get so many stings. If they disturb a hive and the bees collectively attack them, it can really do some damage.
What I've gotten was like 13 yellow jacket stings while weed eating. I was weed eating an overgrown area, and I got 13 yellow jacket stings as well as covered in poison ivy all in the same day. I had mowed over, I was weed eating a weed covered bank and chopped up poison ivy and got stung all at once.
Empathize with you with the poison ivy. I can just about walk by something and get it. You have to be very careful with burning stuff. If you get that stuff in your lungs, it can cause major problems.
That's really bad. That's another thing that's terrible on your lungs right there besides gasoline. Don't ever burn poison ivy. That anybody who's allergic to it, if they breathe that, they can die almost instantly from that.
Reaction time, but I know it's kind of bad. In Army training one time, we had to low crawl through patches of poison ivy. I don't think anybody knew it was there. And people ended up in the hospital from it.
J4WZM. I didn't used to be allergic to it, and then I cleared a quarter acre of it by hand, yanking all the vines out, because I figured, oh, I know I'm allergic to it. And that's where my allergy started from.
Pulled up so that it gets worse, and you don't get adjusted to it, it just gets worse.
It does. I know it popped up really recently in our yard here. As soon as spring showed up, the poison ivy showed up, and I was working in the yard, and I saw a poison ivy leaf literally touch me. I was working on something and hadn't even thought about it. I looked over and seen the tip of a poison ivy leaf touched me. And then the next day I had a red welt there. I still have it. It's on the inside of my elbow. But literally, that's all it took. I literally got taps from it. Boom. Now I have a welt.
Poison ivy and not a spider's bite?
I'm 100% certain. I've seen the leaf do it, and that's exactly where it was. Anytime I get anywhere near it, that's what happens to me. It didn't used to be that bad, but that's what happens. And I've had spider bites before, and I've had poison ivy before, and this was definitely poison ivy and not a spider bite.
It's interesting because when they bite an insect that hits their web, what they're actually doing is starting the digestive process. I had one bite me on my inside of my elbow, and I finally got a antibiotic for it, but it stayed there for years as a spot, and then one day it just disappeared.
I've never heard of that happening before.
After bites, particularly depending on what kind, it's actually injecting as much as the venom, but it's also injecting digestive juices because it's starting the digestive process. So one of the reasons your skin reacts to it is you have digestive juices in there. He's actually, in a sense, eating you, and that's why you've got to take something to counteract that. I had a spot there for, several years, and then all of a sudden, just one day, it disappeared.
I know different spiders have different sets of juices like that they use. One of the most lethal ones is from the black widow spider, and it's actually a neurotoxin. It's designed to shut down the nervous system, and that's particularly dangerous.
They're big, long legs. Daddy long legs or the granddaddy long legs, are different names, and they're actually one of the most poisonous ones. However, their mouth is not big enough to bite a human.
That's one that I actually knew. Those are pretty interesting things. Did you know they don't actually qualify as a true spider? And do you know why?
Don't have enough legs or something like that?
8 legs. In fact, another interesting fact is scorpions actually count as arachnids because they have 8 legs. But the reason why the Dotty Longlegs does not qualify as a true spider is because it has 2 eyes instead of 8.
that. I generally stay away from them.
Poisonous. Well, not to us, at least. You're not going to get hurt by them. You can have 200 of them all over your body, and you're not going to be injured from them at all. Also, one thing that I've noticed is it's like their head is built into their body. Insects have head, thorax, and abdomen, and then I think spiders, it's called a cephalothorax and abdomen. It's the head and thorax combined, and then their abdomen. And I think daddy long legs is their only one unit instead of two.
Had all kinds of spiders around the house, really bright colored ones. And I usually left them alone. I figured they were eating other insects because we don't have mosquitoes here. I think we have enough wind to keep them away. But I was very interested. But we started having bug spray, and I think that drove them off. And I was kind of sorry to see that because they were always very interested in watching those. You sound very familiar with all the biology. How did you learn all that?
I was interested in that kind of stuff at a really young age, and I guess you could say I'm much more of a nerd when I was younger, and I got into books a lot more than I do now, and I read up on all that stuff. I had insect guides and different things like that. I learned about all that kind of stuff.
Interesting hobby. I would suggest you keep up with it. It will keep you occupied and give you something more to learn about.
That's actually what my brother went to college for. He went to college for that stuff.
He was a company called The Greatest Courses online. They go to colleges and pick out people they consider the best professors, lecturers, and they produce their worst tapes and then CDs, and now you get them, you download them, and you can actually download a college course, usually around 30 lectures of about half an hour to 45 minutes apiece, on just about any subject that you can think of. Literally any subject, history to biology to cooking to whatever. You might look those up and find some interesting things about insects and biology.
Another one that I'd be interested in is meteorology, anything weather related. My favorite stuff about meteorology is weather history and forecasting.
The Greatest Courses, I think that's what they're still called. If you're going to buy any of it, wait until they go on sale. They usually have a couple of sales a year when their prices are way down.
Do it.
Anything on it, get back to me, and I'll dig out some addresses for you.
Do you know much about weather?
Sales, one time I studied it, but it's been a long time since I really have done anything to pay attention or learn more about it.
That's basically what I would like to look into when I decide to finally retire. I'd like to get a college degree before then, though. I need to get I really need to try to get a master's degree in it, but I'm not ready to sit down and go to school yet. I'll reach that point, and I'm going to work towards reaching that point. But that's basically what I would like to have as my game plan for my so-called retirement. I don't actually ever plan to retire. I'd rather not. I want to have stuff to always keep me busy. But when I'm not so physically active anymore, I would prefer to be able to sit down at a desk and look at that kind of stuff.
Your mind active all the time. I used to teach college. I taught English. And I would suggest that the first courses you take would be English. A lot of people like to put that off. But for a lot of courses, particularly correspondence courses, you have to write papers. And the first couple of courses in English are how to write papers. And your grades in psychology, history, and on are based on your writing ability. So you need to know how to write term papers.
Good at. That's one thing I definitely do not enjoy, but I'm good at it.
said I know how to write papers, and I know how much work is involved in it, and I do not like writing them.
Citations and proper formats, all that kind of stuff, it's a big headache. I know how to do it, but it's definitely not something that's very exciting to me whatsoever.
Let me take a quick break. I want to go look up something and maybe give you an address and phone number.
K4WZM.
R-O-N. Did you write something down? Have changed because I pulled out one and it's an old one. It's on the Queen of Sciences, a history of the mathematics. Very good bunch of lectures. It's called The Great Courses. It was also called The Teaching Company. The phone number I have is 800-832-2412. And the website, which again may have changed, was www.teachfigure12.com, and that might get you started on these. Since you spend a lot of time on the road, you might find these lectures interesting to listen to on the road.
Sounds good. I'll definitely take a look at that.
Get the CDs on these things now. They don't put them out on CDs. They put them out on other stuff, which I don't really have the capability. Well, I do have a CD player, but they don't put them on CDs anymore in the car. And we would listen to them while we were on trips, anything from science fiction to whatever. But with the Great Courses, they cover all kinds of subjects. And we've listened to things on forensics, on cooking, on spices, history, just all kinds of stuff. And so this will give you an education, even though you may not be getting college credit for it, it'll still give you knowledge.
Very useful. The knowledge is key right there. I might not have a piece of paper in hand, but I do have a lot more knowledge on a lot of things than most people my age, and it really helps.
We'll come back to apply to other things that you're looking at, and I think that's one of the big things about learning is being able to tie it all together. We tend to look at college now from an economic standpoint, and how do you earn a living being whatever, but to me a liberal arts education applies to all the life around you, like the insects you're talking about, the weather, just the space, looking at all the planets, things like that. Well, this company will have lectures on all of those. Some of them are videos, but a lot of them you can get that you can listen to in a truck.
My interests have always been very, very, very heavily biased in the math and science type fields. A lot of that kind of stuff interests me a lot. I think about mathematical equations and physics a whole lot. Not just like random thoughts, but active applications for all that kind of stuff.
It's on everything from basic algebra up through calculus on these courses.
Me out of meteorology school right there. I took calculus 1 and I passed it by 1%, and I can't really remember anything from the class other than that. I hardly understood any of it. I feel like I passed the class by accident, and I definitely can't take calculus 2 or calculus 3 because it builds on that stuff. Couldn't take those and pass it. I'm going to have to go back over and try to learn what I didn't understand.
The thing about a lot of calculus teachers is they're teaching you the mechanics of how to manipulate formulas and stuff and things, and they don't really tie it into how to use it. This company has an interesting course on calculus and gets into what's behind it rather than just making the calculations, it gets into overall the theory behind it so that you can learn how to apply it.
There. See, otherwise it's like teaching me the parts of an engine and what they connect to without showing me how the engine operates and why it does what it does.
I've got to look at something else. I'll be back.
OEZM.
ZRON, over. Find things what I'm looking for. I hadn't looked at this in a long time. This is, it's old enough. I don't know when, what year it was put out, but it was, it's on videotapes to give you an idea. Again, from the Great Courses. And this is a video series, and it's Change in Motion, Calculus Made Clear. There are 6 videotapes on it by a professor, Michael Starbird. You should be able to remember Starbird from the University of Texas. And I would suggest that you look up the, look at this on the teaching company and look for this particular one. It will give you a whole lot of background on the calculus system. Really, what's going on as opposed to just the calculating kind of thing.
Right there. I had a friend of mine, he's now completely and totally incapacitated as of recently from a stroke, but he has his PhD in meteorology, and I always talked to him. I told him, hey, I understand trigonometry and I use it every day, but I don't understand calculus at all. And he said, well, I understand calculus. And I said, well, I guess I just have to learn it so I can get my meteorology degree. He says, well, not necessarily that you can get your meteorology degree. He said, I use calculus almost every day. I have these problems that I think of, and I wonder why something works the way it does, and I run a calculus equation on it. He said, I use it almost every single day. If I have a question about something, I can get an answer because I know how to do the math on it. So I don't even know what it was that he was trying to calculate out, but he insisted that he used it very, very frequently. And told me it was extremely useful. Well, I've never gotten to figure out how to even use it.
A little bit of the summary here. Change in Motion, this is course number 177. 2 parts, 24 lectures, 30 minutes apiece. On the back of this is Einstein's Relativity and the Quantum Revolution, Modern Physics for Non-Scientists, course 153. So these sound, but the calculus one starts off most of the differences in the way we experience life now and the way we experience them in the beginning of the 17th century emerged because of technical advances that rely on calculus. Calculus is a beautiful idea exposing the rational workings of the world. It is part of our intellectual heritage. The exploration of only 2 ideas, both of which arise from a clear, commonsensical analysis of our everyday experience of motion. Separately invented by Newton and Leibniz, has become one of the most fruitful and influential strategies for analyzing our world that has ever been devised. Yet many of us regard ourselves as excluded from profound insights because we didn't enjoy or continue in mathematics. Professor Starbird opened it, and he is on a mission to make calculus accessible to us all. Learning why. He's passionately committed to correcting the bewildering way that the essential beauty and power of calculus was hidden from many of us in school. He begins the course by holding up a college calculus textbook, all 1,200 dense pages of it. He points out that the book consists of 2 ideas and 1,198 pages of examples and application. There. So I think this is a course that you might really enjoy. It's probably in video, but you can. I know your time is hard, but for 30 minutes a day, over a month, you can really get some insight.
Again.
Change in Motion, Calculus Made Clear. It's the course number 177. Now, this is from a few years back, but I'm assuming that they have it available still. It's by Professor Michael Starbird. Of updated and put out on CDs, and now you can probably download it.